Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. And we have what I think is a very interesting issue, but particularly to people who litigate these cases, which is ripeness and mootness. We are always trying to get into court when a regulation comes out.
Ripeness and mootness. You already lost me. Okay, tell me more. Tell me more.
So the case that I want to discuss today is Missouri v. Yellen. And it was in Missouri District Court, and now it's been appealed because the case was dismissed. It's now in the Eighth Circuit. And the problem when you're a cause lawyer like us, we want to get an issue before a court, but the courts have always developed over the years, for good reason, that you can't just be a officious intermeddler. You actually have to have injury to get a decision on an issue. And there are two doctrines that sort of plague us sometimes when we're trying to get a case in. And they are, first, ripeness. Ripeness is, has anything happened to you yet? If nothing's happened to you yet, the court says, get out of here till something happens to you. So that's ripeness. And mootness is, did something stop happening to you? So if something's not happening to you anymore, get out of here. That's mootness. So in Missouri v. Yellen, what's happened there is that Missouri is very concerned about Section 9901 of the American Rescue Plan Act. It's called ARPA, of course, because we've always got to have that acronym. But anyway, ARPA allocates about $220 billion to making payments to the states because they've had some COVID-related setbacks in their budgets. So a huge amount of money was set aside. And Missouri was estimated to have about $3 billion of this money coming to it. However, Congress said that if you take the money, you can't cut taxes. That's part of what's going on here. Now, what does that mean, you can't cut taxes? There's a lot going on. And that's why it's against Yellen, because she's the Treasury Secretary, and she's going to be making the regulations about it. And Missouri argued that a broad interpretation of this offset restriction, meaning that you can't cut taxes if you take this money, that Secretary Yellen, quote, carefully left open the potential application of a broad interpretation. And so what they want to do is make sure that if they cut certain taxes or they do certain things, that it isn't stopped by this regulation and all the money is then snapped back. So think about it. You're a state legislature in Missouri. You're making your budget. You have this money. You think you have this money. It's a large chunk of money. Do you really have it or not? Or can it be clawed back by the secretary? Well, they brought this case to decide what the law actually meant. What does this offset mean? What is this no cutting taxes with this money mean? And the district court said, well, have you cut taxes? Nope. Has Secretary Yellen come after you for anything? Nope. And the district court said, well, get out of here. You can't, don't go looking for trouble. You know, sufficient unto the day are the troubles thereof. So he throws it out. He says, you don't have any problems. Well, what is the practical consequence of that? The practical consequence is that states like Missouri and other states that are discussing how to use this money and whether to cut taxes and which cut taxes to cut and how to arrange their budgets, well, they're obviously arguing when anyone makes a proposal that this proposal will steal $3 billion from the budget. It has real-world consequences. The mere fact that the law exists and that the secretary hasn't said exactly what she's going to do about it causes consequences to the legislature that are actually being discussed in the real world. And yet the ripeness doctrine keeps that out of court, so far, at least. And, you know, there are other problems with this law. I think it goes against this, what the Supreme Court has said about taking over state responsibilities, the budget of the state. If Congress wants to give the state money, that much money, certainly they can't put conditions that sort of change the entire political outlook of the state. I mean, I think it's far overreaching and pretty much commandeering the whole state with that kind of money. But I don't know that that's in this case. But the real issue here is what happens when you have a law with vast consequences that the legislature is considering, and that, in fact, you may stop the tax cuts simply by making the law exist. And if you do that and the secretary never comes after you, huge amounts of state fiscal policy all across the country have been affected. And yet no one will ever be able to challenge whether or not the law is constitutional or not. And that's a problem I see with this doctrine in these type of cases, Mark.
If the court gets this ripeness analysis wrong, I think your point is, look, if real world legislators are actually engaged in debates about whether or not they're going to change state law or whether they can cut taxes and so forth, then the damn thing ought to be ripe to litigate because it's obviously having a real world impact.
Well, yeah, especially, for those judges who like legislative history, the fact is that if I have a bunch of guys on the floor of the state house saying, look, I think this would be good. I think we'd bring in more revenue. Like they make a supply side argument, right? They say, I think our car tax is way too high, and that I want to cut the car tax because I think we'll have more people buy more cars and produce more cars. Maybe it's Michigan or something. So I want to cut the car tax. I think it's revenue. It'll increase revenue, actually. That's my bet. But I'm not going to do it because I really don't want to lose this $3 billion. So I'm going to defer to the federal government on this. And I'm sorry to my constituents, but my hands are tied. You have that kind of statement on the floor and you have votes influenced by that kind of statement. It strikes me that it's a real issue and it's not speculative damage. It's real damage to one side of, the fiscal argument. It is real. But I suppose, Mark, that could have effects on the other side. They could say, well, look at this law that prohibits the use of these funds, that these federal funds for this purpose or that purpose. Now, I think that's a different thing because of the federal funds. For instance, you can't use the federal funds to buy foreign materials, right? You got to buy American. Well, is that constitutional or not? Do you get to go to court on that? You haven't bought anything that year. I mean, that's probably a bad example, but it's a common example.
Yeah, I think it's a decent example because it shows that there are conditions that they can put on there that aren't really. I mean, it doesn't really constrain the state's frame of choice, right? Or their array of policy choices. It's a very marginal sort of thing to say, buy American. But to say you can't cut taxes, that's a pretty central violation of the autonomy of the state.
Yeah, and the other thing about it is that it's one thing to say what you do with these federal monies can be constrained, but what you do with your own money if you take these federal funds is a different question.
Exactly. Well said.
That's really what's going on here. We have a lot of conditions that if we're going to have federal funds, you can't do certain things with that federal money that you wouldn't get otherwise. But, a state has its own taxation powers. In fact, it's a core power of the states. It's probably, along with the police power, the two major indicia of sovereignty that are left to the states. And to impinge upon it in this way is really amazing. And I think Janet Yellen knows this. I will say she does seem to actually not want to lose a case on this. So I do think that, one of the reasons she gets a lot of criticism from the left side is they don't think she's being aggressive enough on this and other issues. But, you know, I suppose a clever, cautious bureaucrat could actually keep it unripe by not doing anything about it, I suppose. But it does. It's on the books. It's a lot of money. It's a marker for future action. So I think that the litigants there should really bang the drum and well, it's in the appellate court, so I guess the record's made now, however it is, because you can't put new information into the record. Well, I don't know about that, Mark. Maybe you can take judicial notice of floor debates in the appellate court. Maybe you can. But anyways, I think that,
I wouldn't hesitate. I wouldn't hesitate to bring that to the court's attention. I think that's judicial notice worthy.
Yeah, I think so too. Mark and I, what we're discussing here is that in appellate courts, you're not allowed to put in new evidence. That's you're not supposed to be doing that. It has to be on the record below. But I do think that official acts can be looked at by the appellate court. So maybe you could do that. But I really do think that's the argument. It has real world effects. That she hasn't done anything. The mere existence of the law is changing the playing fields and changing the outcome for the state residents in ways that are go to the core functions of the state. So I'll be watching that case. I may bring it up again. I'm pretty sure that the litigants there, the state of Missouri, will want to go to the Supreme Court at some point if they lose. But I also think that as time goes by, the administration may actually start cracking down on these states because this was put in for a political purpose. People are moving to Florida, right? There's no income tax. They're all leaving New York and New Jersey and places like that. And when the Republicans were in, they stopped the one-for-one reduction in state taxes from federal taxes. Whatever you paid in state taxes, you didn't have to pay in federal taxes. They took that away and the liberal states think that was a shot across their bow, and this is a shot across the conservative states' bow. So I think it'll get to court sometime, but right now it's being checked out by right. And we'll be back in a little bit.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. And Vec and I, in this last segment, we're going to talk about an article that I ran across this past week. It was published on August 30th at Zero Hedge. And the author is Ryan McMacken of the Mises Institute. So I want to give full credit off the top there. The article title is Why So Many Americans Reject Legal Due Process in the Age of COVID. And I think that this may be the most important article I've read this year, Vec. I at the risk of hyperbole, I think that the ideas here are really powerful ideas and very much at the heart of what the New Civil Liberties Alliance is fighting against and why it's so necessary. So let me see if in a 12-minute segment here we can dig in and explain what Ryan McMacken is, the point that he's making. And really, it's not Ryan McMacken's point, as he's quick to point out. It's Bertrand de Jouvenel, Jouvenel, a French political scientist who wrote an essay in the 1960s entitled The Political Consequences of the Rise of Science. And so that's really what Ryan is taking the insights of Bertrand de Jouvenel and applying them to what's been happening the last 18 months during the COVID pandemic. So let me jump in here. We all know what's happened in terms of folks being ordered to stay in their homes and abandon their jobs. And there's largely been, and this was part of what our lawsuit against the governor of Massachusetts was about in the DeRozier's case. This is being done with no legal process. Folks don't have the opportunity to tell the governor, hey, I actually, you know, you've put my business in a category of not being essential, but it is essential for these reasons. There's no due process hearings that were even given for that sort of thing. Or If someone was forced to lock down, they couldn't say, well, there's reasons why you shouldn't lock down my business. And so we saw all of these kinds of irrationalities where I remember one small town in Massachusetts, there were only four or five businesses on Main Street, and they were all open except for one because it didn't happen to fall into the exception. So really, when governments and particularly administrative agencies and governors and mayors and people who are using executive power, when they make these sweeping one-size-fits-all decisions without due process, without the opportunity for individuals to assert their individual interests, you get this kind of bad results for lots of people. But you know, lockdown advocates insisted, and this is Ryan McMacken, talking here. Could be McMacken. In any event, says the lockdown advocates insisted that the public instead embrace unreservedly the recommendations of experts in government offices. Were one to suggest in mixed company that businesses ought to be afforded a hearing before being forcibly closed, or that an individual ought to receive some sort of due process before being deemed a non-essential worker, this was likely to elicit scoffing and contempt. There's no room for due process anymore, the official narrative tells us. And what he says instead is there's a new turn toward obedience. And Ryan points out that this is part of a longer process, that the legal process that we're used to, that our founders bequeathed us in the Constitution, is slowly eroding and being replaced in a more scientific kind of approach. That the rise of classical liberalism, Bertrand Juvenal pointed out in his essay, again, The Political Consequences of the Rise of Science, took care to erect legal obstacles that slowed state action on behalf of individual rights with due process. This was respected in the late 18th century, in the 19th century. The American experiment is all about this. The United States Constitution is all about protecting people's rights with due process. The Fifth Amendment, due process. The 14th Amendment, due process at the state level is what the 14th Amendment ensures. And so we have two of our most important constitutional amendments. I mean, if you, John, I assume your law school is the same way. Most law schools, you have Con Law 1, which is basically the entire Constitution. Then you have like a Con Law 2, which is often just the First Amendment. And then you have Con Law 3, which is typically the 14th Amendment, right? Due process often gets its own class in constitutional law in law schools. Due process is so important to lawyers and the legal process.
Yeah, but go ahead. I will say this. The other thing about it, about Juvenal and this article is that they use the word science. I would call it the technocracy, because you can't tell me that these people doing these things are better scientists than Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, who put together, you know, our founding documents. There, it is a deference to people who have this expertise, and an unquestioning deference. I mean, I'm just stunned by, you know, there's emerging facts, and then they just look at this person and they have this degree. And so, okay, there's emerging facts. It could go one way, but we're just going to follow this guy. It's incredible.
It is incredible. And it's not that the people on the wrong side of the debate are charlatans with sheepskins, although right. Well, that happens sometimes.
I like
too,
that term. That's a good term.
Thank you. But you know, that happens sometimes with government experts, but you know, that's not the usual problem. The usual problem is what John just referred to, that you have this technocratic expertise. And sometimes it's just a result of, look, if you're a hammer, everything you look at is a nail. If you're, you know, if you're the CDC and all you see is health issues, you don't really know anything about housing policy. You don't know that your eviction moratorium is going to raise the price of housing for everyone 6 months from now, or 18 months from now, or 24 months from now, where landlords are now demanding 6 months rent ahead of time for any new tenants in some places. Well, why do you think they're doing that, CDC? Because of your dumb eviction moratorium, right? So it's sometimes this silos or tunnel vision, maybe is the better term.
And Mark,
that technocrats have.
And it's also, I will tell you this, I've worked with some very very famous surgeons who've written the book on their type of surgery. They've all admit, they'll admit outright that I always send my patients to other people because all we want to do is cut. And he's saying, right. Because I'm one of the greatest surgeons in the country, but for diagnosis and things like that, even in that area, he sends them out because his interior thought process and what he knows is taking things out and changing things around. But he also knows that there are other approaches, and he wants the patient to know them. And I don't know that our technocrats do.
Yeah, the best diagnostician isn't necessarily the best surgeon, and vice versa. Right. And I think that's true across all areas of expertise, not just medical science. And look, the immunologists are the ones that have relevant expertise when it comes to the pandemic. And the immunologists are telling us that, and this isn't unique to COVID, this is true of every virus, right? That there is such a thing as naturally acquired immunity. And that if you already have naturally acquired immunity to, say, chickenpox as a 4-year-old because you've had it and recovered from it, then they don't give you the chickenpox vaccine before you go to school, even though kids who haven't had chickenpox have to get the vaccine. And yet we have these folks at the FDA and CDC and White House that are ordering people to get the vaccine, even though they've already had COVID and have the naturally acquired immunity. This is what Ryan and what DeJuvenal talk about as the model for society shifting from a courtroom or a parliament to a laboratory. And so there's this desire for lightning fast scientific efficiency, that the experts are going to tell us the proper goals of the government policy, and then the government is supposed to impose coercive measures necessary to get that result as quickly as possible. The government uses its police powers. And so legislative process or due process in the courts are impediments to accomplishing these scientific goals. And this, you know, under the old system that DeJuvenal was talking about, the one, again, that our founders bequeathed us, the legislature was supposed to take the lead, right? Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution is the legislative branch. And with the executive acting just to carry out legislators' wishes. That was the Lockean model. That was the Madisonian model, if you prefer. But in today's world, that regime defers to scientific expertise. And if our judges are going to defer to these technocrats, to the executive power, which has the upper hand, which can act more quickly than the legislature, then these due process rights are going to fall by the wayside. And so that's why science is a contributory influence to the dissolution of a juristic order. That's what Juvenal says. And growing executive power, Ryan points out, is a natural fit for a society geared toward technocratic expertise. And if the courts and the legislatures follow the lead of decisive action taken in the name of science, then essentially we can kiss our due process rights goodbye. And it'll only be months after the fact that people who oppose the executive's policies can gain some semblance of legal rights and due process through the courts or legislative action. But by then, you know, grave damage may already be done. And so I commend the entire article to folks. We've, you know, gone through the basic points here. But let me just make one more quick point, Vec, and then I'll turn it over to you. This is what the New Civil Liberties Alliance is about. We understand that the administrative state is prone to this sort of technocratic action and to moving too swiftly and without paying heed to people's due process rights. And that's why we need the legislatures involved in the COVID response, and we need the courts to stop deferring to administrative agencies. Go ahead, Vec.
And I would just say, you know, it does remind me that I was in the Soviet Union that was, and they always, always, always said that everything they were doing was scientific. It was scientific socialism. Everybody in the top echelons was an engineer. They were very, very pro-science, as you will, and very, very non-pro-due process.
Yes, yes. And also very anti-dissent, right? I mean, the scientific process in the United States is supposed to be a model where people have hypotheses that can be disproved, but they're not interested in hearing objections to the government's version of science when it comes to COVID. Thanks for being with us on Administrative Static. We'll see you next week.